This is an ABC podcast.
Bula Vinaka Yandra, and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Evan Wasuka, standing in for Agnes Tupou on this Monday morning. And what a show we have for you today. As Tuvalu's first cohort under the Fale Pile Union prepare to relocate to Australia, community activists are warning that more preparations are needed.
The reality of and the challenge around finding accommodation for the transitioning family and helping them settle in.
And coming up, we are going to head to Solomon Islands to find out what the talk of the town is. Here's a clue.
As a Solomon Islander, me barawa, happy to much for looking Pacific Island Nation come together.
We'll have more on that later. And in sport news, this Fiji rugby star is going out in style, announcing her retirement from international rugby after a thrilling win at the Rugby World Cup.
Just kept reminding myself that I wanted to end my career on a high, and that's what we did today. We beat Wales for the first time.
We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We start this morning in the Solomon's capital, Honiara, where regional leaders arrived over the weekend for this week's Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting. The summit brings together heads of governments from across the Pacific to discuss everything from climate financing to regional security. But there's been controversy in the lead-up to this meeting, with Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele blocking dialogue partners, including Taiwan and China, from participating. Now, with the forum trying to maintain its unity, the question is whether geopolitics will overshadow this week's Pacific-led agenda. To chat more about this, we're going to head over to the Solomon's capital, Honiara, to join the ABC's Solomon Islands reporter, Chris and Rita Omanu-Leong. But first, here's some sounds from the capital.
Pacifica!
That's the sounds from the Solomon's capital as Honiara prepares for this week's Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting. Good morning, Chris and Rita.
Good fellow morning, Evan.
Now, Chris and Rita, tell me about what sounds we just heard and what's the mood like in the capital as we prepare for the high-level talks.
Well, the sounds that you just heard there were from the church service, and you can clearly tell what the highlight of this week would be, which is Pacifica, and it's all about the Pacific. And so that was the choir at the church service yesterday, where although many Pacific leaders have started coming into the country, only a few had attended the church service, and that was to, you know, start off things for a busy week this weekend, Honiara's capital. But the mood itself, you know, there's this sense of pride as well from Solomon Islanders in hosting yet another regional meeting, the last being in 2023 when Solomon Islands hosted a huge event. Perhaps not the numbers, like 5,000 for Pacific Games at that time, but now it's like almost like 1,000. But it was one of the big events, and it's one of the ones for Solomon Islands this week as well. Look, this regional meeting, it has brought in some sense of curiosity as well among Solomon Islanders here. We are now seeing a lot of vehicles going through from east to west in Honiara, and new vehicles ushering the leaders, roadworks, you know, infrastructure improvements across the capital of Honiara itself, but also in Western Province, where the leaders' summit is to take place later this week. It's a mixed feeling on the streets. Some do not have any clue about what is happening, but there are others who want to see a positive outcome and understanding to the issues that will be raised or that will be discussed in Solomon Islands capital of Honiara. And let's take a listen to some of those voices.
What leaders from 18 countries from across the Pacific Ota come to today for Ota come for a meet together for talk about the issues where affecting environment limit and also what not solutions blota for Ota issues.
as a Solomon Islander, me barawa happy to mas folukin Pacific Island Nation come together and just a country am hosting the Salam meeting. Me bara so proud to mas blo country from Iomi Solomon Islands.
Yeah, Evan, so those are some of the voices on the street, while others did not have any comment to say. They are looking forward to what the outcomes will be this week and going forward in what looks like a frenzy of diplomatic activity in Solomon Islands.
Thanks for that, Chrissy. I was wondering which leaders have so far touched down in Honiara ahead of the start of proceedings?
Yeah, so I've seen at the church service three leaders at least, the Tongan Prime Minister. I've also seen the Tahiti Prime Minister, but we do know as well that the Tuvaluan Prime Minister has touched down here, and Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, is also here in country. But we are expecting a number of these leaders to start coming in later on this week, especially ahead of the Leaders' Summit, which will happen on Thursday. So we're expecting, for the first time to Solomon Islands, we're expecting Australia's Prime Minister as well, Anthony Albanese, and New Zealand's Prime Minister to be among the different leaders who will start to make their appearance here in Honiara.
Now, Chrissy, in the past week, we've seen both Beijing and Canberra gift new equipment to the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force. How is all this being viewed locally, and does it feed into concerns that there's outside influence shaping the security landscape there in the Solomons?
Evan, it did raise a few eyebrows here in the capital, given the timing as well, you know, just a week or two before this important regional meeting. But the fact that it came in almost like every day we were seeing this on the newspaper or on press releases, donations of over 100 vehicles and police capability equipments, a donation that Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manele says will boost the security preparations ahead of this PIF's meeting. But it kind of brought back a similar undertaking that we saw back in the 2023 during the Pacific Games, when there was a influx of all these donations that came through, and certainly it brought some concerns as well. There are concerns and some arguing that, you know, China and Australia policing programs are running parallel, and it's fueling competition without meeting really the needs of the local police force itself, or the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force. Some say as well, some Solomon Islanders say the resources like these vehicles that are being donated can be better used in clinics or hospitals where there's shortages in ambulances. So all these issues have been the talk of town, and this is something that many Solomon Islanders who are, you know, they're the main, you know, the people who are the labors and resources, who drive the economy. When they see these kind of things happening, there are a lot of questions as well.
That's certainly very interesting. Now, what are the key issues leaders are expected to talk about, to debate over the coming week? And what are some things that might spark the most contention among the leaders themselves?
Evan, at the top of the card is climate change, and it's not only for Solomon Islands, but across the region, and the Pacific's race to access the resources and funding that it needs. We also expect Pacific leaders to officially approve and operationalize the Pacific Resilience Facility, and the International Court of Justice as well, the advisory opinion on climate change is the other one where Pacific countries will press major polluters to move with much more urgency to cut emissions. So at the top of it, climate change. This meeting will also be an endorsement for Australia's bid to co-host the COP31 climate meeting with the Pacific next year. So that's something that we are also expecting. The Ocean of Peace, as I mentioned earlier, Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka is already in Honiara, and he has been championing the Ocean of Peace. So this will be debated and likely approved. But Pacific nations are moving also with their own conservation agenda, and we're expecting the announcement of a new Melanesian Ocean Reserve, which will become one of the world's largest protected zones. But like you, as you asked earlier about the controversy, it might have to be to do. It might, experts say it, prior to this meeting, there has been criticism from countries with the decision of Solomon Islands as host to defer around 24 post-forum dialogue partners. So this will probably be the one that will bring a stir up controversy. Here we can expect plenty of controversy, particularly around that, because some Pacific nations have accepted the explanation from Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele, but it doesn't seem like they will take their eyes off some of the non-Pacific nations who have diplomatic representatives here in Honiara, like Japan, UK, China, US. So we will watch a stake. We will be following this closely this week, Evan.
Chrissy, and finally, what does this year's PIF Forum Leaders Meeting mean for Solomon Islanders themselves, given all the focus on security, aid and development partnerships?
Evan, for many Solomon Islanders, they say that the true development must begin with them, and that's to improve their lives and to build stronger communities. So with this regional meeting here being hosted in Solomon Islands, a country that is highly dependent on aid, people want to see leaders prioritize the needs, their needs, with majority of Solomon Islanders living outside of the capital, Honiara. They are often forgotten at high-level meetings such as this. So they want to see their leaders take into consideration things that are important to them. It's accessing clean and running water, proper sanitation. How do they access a climate resilience fund to address food security challenges outside of Honiara itself? So on top of that, Evan, Solomon Islands will tonight receive the chairmanship role of PIFS for next year, which means it's a huge responsibility as well to drive these discussions and the outcome of the meetings.
Chrissy, thank you, Thomas, for this morning's update on the Pacific Leaders Meeting.
Thank you, Thomas, Evan.
And that was the ABC's reporter in Solomon Islands, Chrissy Nrita Omanu-Leong, giving us an update ahead of this week's Pacific Island Forum Leaders Meeting. We have a big team there in Honiara that's keeping us up to date across the week about all the happenings taking place at the PIF Leaders Meeting. Bougainville's Electoral Commissioner Desmond Tsianai has commended the people of the Autonomous Region for strong turnout and peaceful polling during the general election. Commissioner Tsianai says there was a strong turnout by voters on Friday, which was peaceful and orderly. He says polling was extended in some areas to allow those waiting in line on Friday evening to cast their votes the next day. He says the decision for these cases were made by the assistant returning officers at certain polling stations. The ABC understands that vote counting will start this week, with the election results to be ready by the 22nd of September. United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres has come under criticism for refusing to call out corruption in Papua New Guinea during his recent visit there. Mr. Guterres was in PNG for the country's 50th independence anniversary, but he refused to answer questions on corruption from the national newspaper Post Courier. It prompted the paper to call out the UN chief, calling for him to cut the crap in the headlines. The ABC's PNG correspondent Marion Farr with more.
It was an uncomfortable end to a four-day visit. Antonio Guterres departing PNG with words of admiration for the country, but refusing to respond to a newspaper editorial urging him to cut the crap and call out corruption in PNG. It's the first time a sitting Secretary General of the United Nations has visited the Pacific country. But in a highly critical op-ed, a leading national newspaper told the UN boss to stop paying lip service to PNG politicians, saying corruption is the biggest hindrance to the country's development. When the ABC put questions to the Secretary General in a press conference, he refused to confront the issue. PNG Prime Minister James Marape hit back at the newspaper, referring to PNG's Independent Commission Against Corruption, which was set up 2 years ago but has been plagued with leadership issues and has only made one arrest. The comments come as PNG prepares to celebrate 50 years of independence, but much of the country still struggles with access to basic services like health, education and electricity.
And that's the ABC's PNG correspondent Marion Farr reporting there. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. A Tuvaluan activist says there are support and housing gaps that need to be addressed for the 280 Tuvaluans set to migrate to Australia this year. Under the Australia-Tuvalu-Falepili Treaty, a security and climate agreement, Tuvaluans will be eligible to migrate to Australia each year as it deals with rising sea levels. In return, Tuvalu won't sign any security or defence deals with other countries without Australia's agreement. The first cohort of Tuvaluans were picked via ballot at the end of July and are now planning their move to Australia. Teresa Lifuka-Dredhala is a sustainable development activist who works with communities in Tuvalu, and she spoke with reporter Jordan Fennell about her observations of the migration pathway from a Tuvaluan perspective.
With regards to Falepili, a group of friends and I were discussing it when it first came to light, public knowledge that this treaty exists. And I was asking, and I said, what does Falepili mean to you, you know? And there were opinions, there were responses around, oh, it means being the Good Samaritan, helping your neighbor. But there was one that resonated with me, and he said, Falepili is helping your neighbor, but expecting nothing in return. So I said, okay, that doesn't really sound like what's happening here. However, now I'm more open-minded to how things will play out, watching both ends and hoping that the gaps would be addressed once we've been able to identify them, that there would be processes and policies in place that would strengthen the transition, and that at least Tuvaluans that move to Australia would be safe.
On the idea of helping with nothing in return, obviously in this particular treaty, both are giving in certain ways, but one of them I know that you're quite passionate about is to do with climate change. Tuvalu is at risk of rising sea levels, of severe impacts by climate change. Australia is one of the biggest carbon emitters. What is your reflection on that dynamic?
Yeah, well, they haven't been very good neighbours. To be sincere, and I know that this has been articulated by our Prime Minister himself. This new government came in and expanded coal and gas. So how does that look like in terms of the Falepili Treaty when they're supposed to look out for our security? You know, security just does not mean invasion of another country. Or security also means our livelihood. Security also means against the impacts of climate change. It's no longer lowering carbon emissions. You need to phase out fossil fuels because there's only so much infrastructure and adaptation that Australia can help with, but yet with the other hand they're continually expanding gas and coal. So they need to truly show that they're our neighbor in the true essence of, you know, Falepili.
The Falepili Treaty is a climate and security arrangement. And when the ballot was announced, you know, there were headlines around the world saying that thousands of Tuvaluans were putting in their names to try and become climate migrants. How do people in Tuvalu actually see this choice of putting their names into that ballot?
From my observations, from my discussions in the spheres that I work with and navigate in, I do know that it's looked at as an alternative pathway. Those that are not familiar with the technicalities around the treaty are comparing it to the Pacific Access Category visa with New Zealand, also comparing it to the Pacific Engagement visa with Australia. So no one is really coming to say that I've heard is say that, oh, this is a climate change visa, we're going to go because of the impacts of climate change. No. Based on the national consultations that have been undertaken around Falepili, it's just a mobility pathway for those who choose to go to study, to work, upskill, with the hope that they will also give back to Tuvalu.
Now, you moved to Australia yourself a few years ago as part of your studies. What were some of the challenges you faced then and things that helped that people migrating under the Falepili Treaty may also face?
I could say that what helped me was my family here at Rona Street. I know that I wouldn't have enjoyed Melbourne without his support, without the family support as well here. I say this because even though I contributed to shopping, but you know, it wasn't like what everyone else was going through. My colleagues around me, they were paying rent, weekly rent, and that's not common in Tuvalu. You pay monthly rent, and Melbourne is a bigger city. We're not in one of the regional areas, so it was heavily regulated. You could not just get a job quickly. I thought that applying for even to be a busker at a restaurant would be easy for me, but it wasn't, you know. That was the reality, and that was a challenge that I saw not only for myself but for my colleagues around me. And what got me by was having my family here that I lived with, and I believe that would be the same for those that are transitioning over. However, that was a short-term plan for when I was studying here. And, you know, we can't force this idea upon the diaspora here. They themselves are living their lives. They themselves are trying to build their families. And, yes, we do believe in that helping hand, but the reality is how challenging and complex Australia is. You cannot expect a transitioning family from Tuvalu to stay here for 6 months to a year with a family that's still trying to build themselves up here. That would be quite selfish. That would be quite selfish. So, with that said, this is a gap that needs to be addressed by both the Falapili office in Tuvalu and Canberra. The reality of and the challenge around finding accommodation for the transitioning family and helping them settle in. It wouldn't be as easy as it sounds.
With 280 people possibly migrating away from Tuvalu each year, what social impacts will this have? I understand there's been a disruption of the social fabric already through other migration pathways. What are we seeing happen in Tuvalu because of that?
So based on my observations and also my work in the outer islands, I've noticed that there are a higher number of women-led households because of the husbands or older brothers who have left, or fathers have left to go on these mobility schemes. This has also impacted children. In some households, their grandparents are looking after the children because the parents have left on these mobility schemes, and this is something that needs to be addressed as well. I know we've had this conversation in our civil society groups and trying to find ways in which we can mitigate these impacts. We do know the reality that these families are going so that they could provide remittance, money, a better life, or so they say, like just money to survive in Tuvalu. But we need to find ways in which the impact on our families wouldn't be so harsh, wouldn't be so great. And then you have Falapili, where households would be uprooted and taken, or dependents will all move. How would this impact the social structures, the family structures, as more often than not, most families live in extended families? What would this look like? Especially since the definition of a nuclear family on the application is not including your parents, you know?
Looking ahead to the rest of this particular year, this first year of the migration pathway happening, what will you be keeping a close eye on? What will you be watching for?
I'll be watching for the team in Tuvalu, the Falapili team, how they interact with the recipients of the Falapili Treaty, how this assistance is rendered, the process of how they are hoping to transition the first 280. Also, trying to get a feel of the conversations amongst the 280. I know that the Falapili team often uses the recipients of the Pacific Engagement Visa as an example, saying that some of them were very excited and just abruptly left without receiving more information as to what life in Australia would entail or what would it look like. So it's just keeping an eye on this and seeing if the information has been disseminated clearly, the assistance as well, because I know that there's only so much people can comprehend at a time, but it needs to be done practically as well for us to really see it. Okay, so this is what will happen when I receive the visa. This is what will happen when I get to Fiji. This is what will happen when I get to Australia. So I'll be keeping an eye on that and just hoping that with each household that departs, there would be a gap identified and a way to mitigate that.
And that's Tuvalu Sustainable Development Activist Teresa Lifuka-Dredala speaking there to the ABC's Jordan Fennell. You're listening to Pacific Beat on this Monday morning. I'm Evan Wasuka, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. And just a recap on our top story today. Pacific leaders are gathering in the Solomon's capital, Honiara, for the Pacific Forum Leaders Meeting. Now, this is the big one, the annual meeting between Pacific leaders, where they'll be meeting in person to discuss issues affecting the Pacific, from climate financing to security. And as mentioned by a reporter on the scene, Honiara is set for this important get-together. And in the lead-up to this year's event, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele opted not to include development partners in this year's session. It's unclear how this will affect the dynamics this week, but we'll certainly have more on that story throughout the week from our team on the ground in Honiara.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
After a week of vote counting, Samoa's general election results were declared over the weekend by Samoa's head of state. The FAST party, under leader La'aoli Ale Malietoa Le Uatea Schmid, has claimed 30 of the 51 parliamentary seats, with the Human Rights Protection Party in second place with 14 seats. Caretaker Prime Minister Fiame Naomi Mata'afa's Samoa Uniting Party is out of the picture with just 3 seats, including her own. Joining me now to discuss the results is political analyst Langi Poeva, Dr. Sherelle Jackson. Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat, Langi Poeva.
Talofa, good morning.
Now, the election results have been declared. Both Australia and New Zealand's prime ministers have issued congratulatory messages to La'aoli Schmid. When will he become officially the country's prime minister?
So currently we're still waiting on there will be an announcement by the head of state to do that official transition. But you also have to remember there's still court cases to be attended to. But usually in previous elections, within 3 weeks, the transition should have happened.
Now, Langi Poeva, the election results, they show a broad shift in Samoa's political culture and voter expectations. What's your take on the election results that were finally officially announced over the weekend?
Thank you, Evan. I think it surprises a lot of people, but also very unsurprising for some of us. There has not been a shift. If anything, the voters in Samoa have doubled down on their support for FAST, which continues to be the ruling party. The reason for the current caretaker prime minister, for Fiame, to have come into power was because of the establishment of FAST. They won in the last election, and they have just won again in this election. So there hasn't been much of a shift in terms of where the country wants their leadership to come from. The surprising piece here is that there was a general expectation that HRPP would do a lot better, given that they've had time to rebuild their base and to strategize to come back into power. But unfortunately, they came in with less than 15 seats.
What about the caretaker Prime Minister Fiame's position? Is that a surprise that she's only picked up her party has picked up 3 seats?
You know, in our previous analysis of the election, every analyst that you would have spoken to before the elections would have said it's mixed. We don't know where it's heading, right? And this result really tells us where the country was leaning towards. This is actually not that surprising, given the fact that there was the last, year, and specifically 6 months of her leadership was very contentious. There were a lot of issues, pertaining to her leadership, which has ultimately led to the snap election.
Hello, Langi, do we still have you there on the line?
Yes, I'm still here. So, you know, the fact that her leadership led to the snap election, you know, therefore this result, you know, speaks to that conscientiousness in her leadership, especially in the final 6 months.
Now, Laoli, what is it about him and the FAST party that has attracted voters that we've seen such an overwhelming, well, they've won 30 seats out of the 51. What do you think is it about FAST and about the leader of the party that's attracted so much votes?
So, you know, Laoli is a very charismatic leader. He appeals to a lot of folks in the rural community, in rural Samoa, and he also just appeals to a lot of diaspora Samoans. He has a very active social media presence. He leans heavily into Christian principles to popularize his message. So as an orator and a chief, he does appeal greatly to Samoans who are very much traditional and very much tied to the land and who are very much tied to village life. And you'll see that a lot of diaspora Samoans are still very much connected to the villages. What is it about Laoli? It's very much that, is that he appeals to people who feel like they haven't been spoken to in recent history by their leaders. Couple that with the fact that some of the FAST parliamentarians or members of parliament in the past, in the recent term, have actually delivered on some of their promises. There's certainly been some issues related to FAST delivering, but, you know, in conversations that I have had with chiefs in villages where FAST is overwhelmingly popular, they're very loyal. In one specific village, you know, the FAST parliamentarian enabled for all the students to go for free to school. And that's the first time in the history of that village. So that loyalty will stay with those villages and those district and that constituent, and it shows in the way that they voted. So it's still very much a rural push, but also motivated by the support from Samoans overseas.
Now, leading up to the election and before, Laoli has cases before the court. What are those charges, and how would this affect his political future, do you think?
So you will see that there are pending charges based on a case that occurred at the beginning of the FAST tenure. Those are still pending. And so that's still up in the air. He has not been charged as of yet, as far as I'm aware. The whole issue pertaining to Fia May, or the current caretaker prime minister, requesting him to vacate his seat was so that he could see the charges through to see where it goes. That is part of the process. Where does this, to your question of how does this play into his leadership or into the current politics, he was voted over 90% of eligible voters in his constituent voted for him. That's the highest percentage of voters for any candidate. Tula Ipa, the former prime minister, was at about 84%. So he's overwhelmingly popular, and somehow voters are not considering that, the pending charges or the pending case into their decision. They are seeing a leader, they are seeing a charismatic leader, and they are voting for him and voting for those in his party. So there's two things to look at here, is that there is an overwhelming majority still supporting the leadership of FAST, and then he himself as a personality continues to receive this type of support. You know, there has been conversations and references by some who likens this to Trump, to Trump's leadership, where there is an appeal to a certain base, irrespective of what he's done. And you see this play out in Samoa's politics.
And do you agree with that sort of comparison with Trump in terms of Laoli? Is he like Samoa's version of Trump?
I think it's a bit extreme to compare to Trump, given that, you know, it's very different political systems and we have very different ways of judging political leaders. But one thing is for sure, there is a base that had felt neglected for a long time, and Lauli has appealed to that base, and that base has continued to grow, and they have continued to support him.
Mm. Now, earlier you had mentioned that there are election petitions and cases also around the election results. How much of an impact did these have on results if you look back at previous elections?
It has never really. So in the last election, there was going to be an impact on, say, the majority based on the cases that came after the elections. But there has never been a direct shift in government based on the outcomes of these cases. If you look at the results now, FAS has an overwhelming majority of 30 seats. Even if they lose 5 seats, they will still govern. You know, they will have to lose at 17 seats based on these numbers to lose their majority. And I personally, based on history, do not see that happening.
Now, we've had the Human Rights Protection Party leader coming out saying that they're heading straight to court with bribery claims. How do you see this all playing out in the coming weeks and months?
This is very common for elections, for post-election, challenges. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how deep and how far they take it. There's always gray areas in Samoa in terms of of bribery. As you know, even with our cultures, there's always that, you know, spirit of giving and assistance. And so there are always gray areas when it comes to elections petitions on whether it was bribery or a cultural gift and so forth. So in terms of how this will play out, only time will tell, but it will, you know, the likelihood of it having a huge impact on the ruling party is very, very low.
Now, Langipueva, before you head off, I just want to get your thoughts on Fiame. What do you think, the results mean for her leadership and also for her legacy?
I think it is, as a woman leader, no one can take away from the strength of Fiame and what she has done for Samoa and what she has demonstrated in her leadership as a woman. That can never be taken away from her. What is now, you know, up for question for a lot who are discussing her tenure is, was it effective? And did she really come through as a leader to keep the country together and to keep the peace? And, you know, at the end of the day, we ended up in a snap election. So there is that question of, okay, was this done to the best of her ability as a leader to bring the country together and bring this, the end of her tenure peacefully? Did the fact, you know, was the fact that she's a woman leader play into the end of her leadership? You know, one can only tell, but at the end of the day, it's very, very unfortunate at the end of the first woman prime minister tenure as prime minister is a snap election. But you also have to understand that there were so many things working against her from the very beginning of her term. And now we see that she did need this party. She did need the support of FAS, and she and the people voted not just for her, but also for Lauli and for the party that they, you know, that Lauli had started. So, you know, it doesn't bode well for Fiame. You know, she's now in a minority party in government, but you also have to realize that she has survived a lot in politics, and maybe this is just one more challenge for her.
Langipueva, thank you so much for joining us today to share your thoughts about the election results.
Thank you very much, Manuelito.
And that was Langipueva, Dr. Sherelle Jackson. You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Turning to sports news, and it was a brilliant weekend in rugby for Fiji, with the national side winning, both the Flying Fijians and the Fijiana coming out on top in both their matches. The Flying Fijians showed their good form, defeating Samoa 29-15 in New Zealand in round three of the Pacific Nations Cup. The win puts Fiji at the top of the PNC table and allows Tonga to qualify for the 2027 Rugby World Cup. And on the other side of the world, the Fijianas won their final Women's Rugby World Cup match against Wales. The Fijianas ended their campaign on a high, defeating Wales 28-25 in their final pool match. Now, the Welsh team started out strongly, putting the first points up on the board, but the Fijianas piled on the pressure and a try of their own in the seventh minute before taking the lead in the at the break. Wales managed to claw their way back in the second half, but the Fijianas held their cool to clinch the final pool match. Now, for utility forward Asinate Serevi, it was a special match with a star player announcing her retirement following the win against Wales.
A lot of mixed emotions, but definitely content. Been praying about this journey, and I'm just grateful for this team, especially my family back home. Thank you for always being there for me. Just kept reminding myself that I wanted to end my career on a high, and that's what we did today. We beat Wales for the first time, and I am just thankful for Fiji Rugby. Thank you for all the coaches, from Coach Sini Rusi, Coach Male, Coach Moji, Coach Cunningham, for giving me the opportunity to represent Fiji. I thank God for the talent, for blessing me with the talent that I'm able to showcase. And just thank you for all the support and prayers. I wouldn't be here without all my family, and I'm beyond grateful. And I'm happy to say that I'm definitely retiring after this World Cup. And I'm just really proud and excited to see what this team, you know, what this team does in the next World Cup. We keep building every year, we keep building every game, and I believe that we can take Fiji to a different level. That's what we're doing today. This is where we begin, and this is where we build for the next game. So vinakvaleu for everyone. Vinakvaleu to everyone at home. Vinakvaleu to my whole family for supporting me, and love you guys.
That's Fijiana forward Asinate Serevi speaking at the Rugby World Cup in the United Kingdom after announcing her retirement from international rugby. And if the Serevi name sounds familiar, that's because Asinate comes from a rich rugby heritage, her father being Waisele Serevi, the legendary sevens player. Last week, when nearly half a ton of cocaine was discovered in a foreign yacht, Vanuatu's police minister said it was a sign that the Pacific is not isolated from the international drug trade. For Rodrigo Duton, a lieutenant colonel in the Rio de Janeiro State Military Police, who's been dealing with illegal trafficking for almost 28 years, the latest incident has come as no surprise. He told the ABC's Lucy Cooper that the Pacific now acts as a major drug corridor, supplying Australia with cocaine from Brazil.
The Pacific cocaine corridor starts in the Brazilian coastline, mainly the ports of Santos and other ports in south of Brazil, including the southeast of Brazil, where Rio de Janeiro is located. So ports from this area, the southeast and south of Brazil, can easily ship cocaine abroad, including Australia, not only Africa, Europe, and Asia. So this corridor, the Pacific Cocaine Corridor, is the continuation of the Caipira route. There is a land track that starts in three border areas of Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay, and cross the Brazilian territory through Paraná State, São Paulo State, and ends up in the Rio de Janeiro City and Santos City in São Paulo. So it's a long route that can reach almost all over the world.
When we're looking at the Pacific Island nations that don't have as many, you know, perceived, say, resources as a country like Australia, does that mean that, you know, these cartels essentially see these countries as having weakened border controls?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Weaker custom oversight is far weaker in these small islands of the Pacific. There's no comparison to the control in Australia. I've been to your country last year, and I could check inside that you have a very good customs control. So these small islands, they don't have the same resources as you Australians have. So it's easy for them to corrupt officials and to use lack of oversight in customs. So I strongly believe they will keep on using these transshipment points in the Pacific Islands.
Brazil has established a trade route with Vanuatu. What opportunity has this presented to cartels in Brazil?
It's known that the modus operandi of the PCC is to hide some cocaine inside of frozen meat. This trade route to Vanuatu is, if I'm not wrong, it's chicken meat. So it's a frozen product. So they prefer to use the containers, the freezer containers, because it's more difficult for you to inspect. Because many times when you open these containers, you compromise the cargo. So many drug dealers use these freezer containers to hide drugs. And this is an opportunity for the PCC to ship drugs to Australia using the chicken meat trade route.
How do we know that cocaine is, you know, kind of being hidden in these frozen chicken shipments? Like, what proof do we have?
No, we don't have proof so far, but it can be happening right now as we talk. But the modus operandi of the PCC is roughly the same. They change when police forces, when security forces, law enforcement seize their drugs, and then they change the modus operandi. But this is a very traditional one, to hide drugs in freezer containers. So it's easy to predict that they can easily use these new routes to Vanuatu to ship to cocaine.
Recently, Vanuatu has just had its biggest drug bust since 2013. 450 kilos of cocaine was seized from a yacht. Is this what you have predicted will occur and continue to occur?
Yes, I would believe so, because we have a similar case in Australia. A guy that has a yacht that was arrested by the Australian Federal Police. Yeah, I put in my report. So this is as I said before, this is the modus operandi. They corrupt people. They pay a lot of money for yacht owners to do this kind of shipment. So they didn't change the modus operandi they have so far, you know.
So this Pacific cocaine corridor which exists, is there really what needs to happen to, you know, essentially shut it down? Because it's such a big, vast region. I assume the resources needed to stop these cartels from using it would be expansive and costly.
I would say Australia should keep their borders secure, as you already have, in my opinion, and try to tighten anti-corruption systems, because the PCC always try to corrupt public officials and pay a lot of money for individuals to do the trafficking. So once Australia improve the security system, the security borders through anti-corruption mechanisms, I think the country will be safer from this menace.
That's Rodrigo Duton, a lieutenant colonel in the Rio de Janeiro State Military Police, speaking there with ABC's Lucy Cooper. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat for this Monday morning. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And Agnes DuPont will be back on the hot seat tomorrow morning. But stay with us, because right up next is Nisha Daily.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.